as you can see, this is an experiment for me this morning, but there's no way I'm going to be able to stand for the whole time. So if you can't see me because I'm low down, please just shift a little so that you can see me and I can see you. The Jordan River winds throughout the whole Bible. It's a sacred symbol for Jews and Christians and Muslims. Jews remember that their ancestors crossed through the Jordan into the Promised Land. Christians remember that Jesus was baptized in its waters. And Muslims remember Muhammad, whose closest companions were buried along the Jordan River. In today's gospel, Jesus steps into the Jordan not just to be baptized in a symbolic and sacramental action, but to get really drenched in its waters. And I think the question for us today is, are we ready to step into the waters too? As a young boy, Jesus probably climbed into the mountains north of his home in Nazareth. Perhaps he even got as high as the springs that feed the tributaries to the Jordan River. He certainly would have seen farmers in the Jordan Valley using its waters to irrigate their farms. And we know that he walked the shores of the Sea of Galilee, which was formed by the river by century and century again. And as a grown man, after his baptism that we hear this morning, we know that he climbed into the dry hills above the river to wrestle with his call to ministry. So I'm inviting you to walk the Jordan River with me this morning. We could choose to hike along the Colorado River, sacred to the Native Americans who live along its banks, dammed by American engineers, diverted to American land before it ever reaches Mexican land. Or we could walk along the Ganges as it rushes through India and Bangladesh, or along the Nile as it moves north through the nations of Africa. We could be walking along any river on earth, because every river has ecological, human, and spiritual value to the people who live near it. But we're walking the Jordan this morning because it already has spiritual value for us, and because it's crying out for practical solutions to its many problems. For a river with such mighty meaning, the Jordan is very short. It's only 156 miles long. It was once more than 75 feet wide, and it was flanked by willow trees and poplars, and it was filled with fish that could be eaten. Today, at its very best, the Jordan is less than 6 feet deep. It's more like a creek than a river. It flows through some of the most dangerous and disputed land on earth. Its sources begin in the mountains where the borders of Israel, Lebanon, and Syria meet. Below the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan forms the border between Israel and Syria in the north, Israel, Palestine, and Jordan in the south. But the crisis that faces the river is more than an international political situation. Today, environmentalists are blaming Israel, Jordan, and Syria for crippling damage to the river and to its ecosystem. 70 to 90% of the Jordan's waters are used for human purposes along the upper Jordan. And the remaining water flowing south comes from sewage and from contaminated agricultural runoff. Now, just below the beautiful Sea of Galilee, the modern pilgrim comes to Narda-Nit, where the Jordan's waters, engineered by the Israelis, form a beautiful large pool of clean water. More than 600,000 pilgrims come here every year. We have been there. Some of you have been there. Many come there to be baptized or to be rebaptized in the waters. If you only saw the Jordan here, and many people, that's all they see, you would think that the Jordan River is still vibrant and robust. But just a few miles south of Narda-Nit, we come to the Alamat Dam, which diverts all the fresh water into Israel's national water carrier, kind of like the great channel that brings Northern California down to the valleys to the south. A small sewage treatment plant processes the rest and spits out brownish yellow sewage water. Then as the river continues on its way south, the sewage from thousands of Israelis living around the upper Jordan Valley, thousands of Israeli settlers and Palestinians on the West Bank, and 250,000 Jordanians provides the lower Jordan River with most of its water. Here is a ray of hope. Just a few miles further south, you would come to what is called the Island of Peace. To find an Island of Peace anywhere in the world is rare, but to find it in the Middle East is truly a miracle. The land here belongs to Jordan, but it's been owned and farmed by an Israeli kibbutz for 100 years. 100 years ago, when the kibbutz began, they got permission from the King of Jordan to build a power station, and the canals and the dams that were built for that station created an island. In spite of all the conflict that has gone on year after year, 25 years ago, the Israel-Jordan Treaty of Peace agreed to cede the land back to Jordan. The Jordanians agreed to let the kibbutz farmers remain on the land. The kibbutz remains there to this day, and international pilgrims still visit every day. And Friends of the Earth Middle East, which is now called EcoPeace, hopes to a Jordan Peace Park, where people can now only come and see what peace between neighbors at war feels like, but learn how to talk and listen to each other. Just a few more miles south, you come to what has been called Bethany Beyond the Jordan. This is the traditional site of Jesus' baptism. It's been visited and honored for nearly 2,000 years of Christian history. Today, pilgrims walk down the steps that lead to a deck on the river's edge, and if they dare, they step into the Jordan's water. 2 years ago, EcoPeace, an environmental organization, led journalists on a tour of the river. And one of the journalists recorded from this space at Bethany Beyond the Jordan, "One look at the river and we understood why we came on the trip. It was pitiful. The Jordan River, for all its fame, was a narrow, brownish stream that gurgled its way south. On the opposite side, just a few meters away from us in Jordan, was a similar wooden deck where tourists came and went. One pilgrim put on a white cloth and calmly entered the water. The guide, who had been just explaining how the river had turned from gushing rapids into a stream of sewage, stopped mid-sentence as we all watched in horror. There are times when what we believe can tr- truly blind us to the reality right before our eyes. Don't forget, in all his sorrow, the refugees. The Jordan River could be considered the latest victim of the Syrian civil war. More than 3 million refugees have fled Syria to date, and over 500,000 have settled in Jordan. Environmental issues are understandably less important than humanitarian concerns. But the ongoing chaos and the fast increasing number of refugees needing water has reduced the river's flow even further. One of the Jordan's tributaries, the Yarmouk River, flows southwest out of Syria, and it forms the border between Syria, Jordan, and Israel. Close by is the Za'atari refugee camp, the second largest refugee camp in the world, and the largest city, quote unquote, in Jordan. To illustrate the impact that human beings have on water, consider this. As the war heated up and refugees began fleeing in the thousands, the water that had been diverted by Syria from the Yarmouk River, the tributary, that water, which had been diverted for human drinking water and for farmland, suddenly increased 3 years, 4 years in a row. The flow of water coming down the Yarmouk River had been released from the uses upstream, no longer used in farms and towns. Now, Echo Peace Middle East is an organization that is active in environmental peacemaking. It has 40 paid employees, and it has hundreds of volunteers. It has offices in Amman, Jordan, in Tel Aviv, Israel, and in Bethlehem on the West Bank. It publishes scientific and social research. It spearheads national-level advocacy campaigns, and it engages in grassroots community development. One of its major goals, as you can imagine, is the rehabilitation of the Jordan River and the Dead Sea. It's made amazing headway in encouraging cooperation. Sometimes as they work with the Israelis, they keep quiet about the fact that Jordanians are helping. Sometimes when they're speaking with Jordanians or Palestinians, they can't tell them that the Israelis are working on the project too. They take their time introducing each side to the other, so that people just don't automatically walk away. Is it an impossible task? You might think so. But the work that Echo Peace has done with local councils and the media has actually created a public outcry, which convinced the local authorities near the Sea of Galilee to finally build a real sewage treatment plant, which will treat the water before it discharges it into the riverbed. And the proposed Jordan River Peace Park at the Island of Peace is a source of particular hope to Echo Peace, where they imagine the same kinds of conversations that its volunteers are having now will take place, bringing people in from around the region. You have no idea how many statistics I took out of this. So what are we going to do about water? This has been another week when we felt defeated by American politics, alarmed by world leaders threatening war, and overwhelmed by monster hurricanes and earthquakes. Can we, you and I, muster any energy to save the Earth's waters? Every worthwhile task is daunting. It doesn't matter whether you want to save the salmon in the Columbia River or in the Morro Bay Estuary. It doesn't matter whether you want to share Colorado River water equitably or the water in the San Joaquin Delta. It doesn't matter whether your water issue starts with wells in Cambria or in Paso Robles or the cost of treating sewage in Los Osos. If Israelis and Jordanians and Palestinians have peace in a region of war, what could we do here? I know that everybody in this room this morning is already personally doing something to care for the environment. We've learned to recycle, to take shorter showers, to stop using styrofoam cups, and we're trying to let go of our plastic bottles that carry our water around. These are small personal actions that mount up when we're all doing it. But how are we working together to pressure our local officials, our national leaders, to make better decisions about water? So again, if some brave Israelis and Palestinians and Jordanians can cooperate to save the Jordan, can't we muster the patience that's going to be needed to deal with our own neighbors, with our community service districts, with our county, state, and national leaders? How big a task is too big? I'm asking you now to go back to the psalm in your bulletin, Psalm 46. And we did this responsibly earlier, but now I'd like you to do the whole first stanza, including the refrain, with me together. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be moved, though the mountains be toppled into the depths of the sea, though the mountains tremble, and the mountains tremble at its tumult. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. As I see it, there are two ways to hear what the psalm is saying. We could hear it saying, and people over the centuries have heard it saying, don't worry, leave it all to God. Or we can hear it saying, God will give you the strength to do the work before you. What do you hear? Every worthwhile task is daunting, but that doesn't mean it can't be done. Yesterday I showed all this to Rob, and when he read this verse, the mountains toppled into the depths of the sea, he was reminded of the great slide on Highway 1 north of Cambria and the truly mind-boggling job of repairing it. So he asked facetiously, as if you know him, he is wont to do, should we wait for God to fix this? These mountains that have tumbled into the sea? Or could God give us strength? Could God give us the strength to decide the first thing to be done is to decide. decide to fix our infrastructure, to repair our roads and our dams, and then, and I know this is political, but I don't ask your forgiveness, and then proudly agree to pay our taxes so the state of California can fix the road. Rob says, that's one thing he can do. What's your one thing? Amen.